Well, to describe someone as colourful can sometimes be a euphemistic way of implying some kind of shady activity. But when it comes to Bharat Sundaresan, our guest on The Year That Made Me today, it is a literal description of his wonderfully technicolour outfits and outlandish nail art. Bharat grew up in Mumbai, India, as a cricket-obsessed kid, but always felt like a bit of an outsider in the conservative and hierarchical society he grew up in. Those feelings of not belonging led to drug use in his late teens, which quickly spiraled into addiction and led to an overdose that very nearly killed him. But Bharat bounced back from rock bottom, eventually finding his way into the international cricket scene and into the commentary box, and a move to Australia, where he became a citizen in 2025. Bharat Sundaresan, thank you so much for joining us on The Year That Made Me.
Thank you for having me on. And when you say colorful, it doesn't mean that it's just a splash of color. It's more like a burst of color. And I don't believe in, the whole concept of things need to match and things need to go with each other. The more, they don't go with each other, the more I get excited about wearing the color. So no, thank you so much for that beautiful introduction and can't wait.
Well, radio is just not doing justice to your wardrobe, but let's do justice to your life story. All right, tell us about growing up in Mumbai and in particular, the family that you grew up in.
It was an interesting family. I mean, from the outside, it was just any other middle-class family in the northern part of Bombay, as it was called back then. I have one sibling, an elder brother, who now lives in the U.S., or he's lived in the U.S. for years now, but it was an unconventional one to start with. My wife described it best years later when she met all of us, and she said, "You are no family. You're just four individuals who happen to stay under the same roof." And honestly, it wasn't until she said that that I really understood what it was like and why it felt so different growing up. My parents, I must start by saying, really nice people and generous to a fault. I guess if they had one vice, it was their generosity. Very loved in their own social circles. But I guess at some deep level, they just didn't seem ready to have kids. So they were both married pretty late in their life by Indian standards back then anyway. It clearly was more than a handful for them to have two kids. And so we grew up, I almost like to say we grew up in the wild, my brother and I. And what I mean by that is, yes, we had a roof over our heads and a food on the table every day, but there was no affection, there was no love, and there was not a lot of care given. And what I mean by that is we could do anything we wanted. Like, so it was, there are strict families, or there's a strict way of parenting, and there's a lenient way of parenting. And then there's what my parents did, which is kind of just led us to our own devices in an era where there weren't too many devices, which meant that we just chose our own path. And I learned about what it means to have a family, what it means to have relationships, what it means to love, what it means to care, what it means to even be hugged and to hug back outside. And that just in some ways became the story of my childhood, and it still continues to this day. I like to say I never received a hug at home, so I instead decided to hug the world entire and anyone who comes in my way.
But how important was cricket to you from an early age?
It was honestly not just my identity. It was probably my savior from a very young age. So I mentioned my brother. You know, the one thing I unfortunately had to endure a lot at home was a lot of physical abuse from him. And it was quite brutal. And it also was the mental toll that it took on me where, you know, I was just unsure of who I was and what I was, if anyone really even wanted me around. And which is why every time I left home when I was in school or when I was on the cricket field, I just felt like I could be myself, and which was pretty much the same person you see now. I mean, I'm goofy, all over the place, couldn't stop talking, always had the ability to make people laugh and to entertain them. But it was a very different story when I got back home, to the extent I would dread going back home, because like you hear in many different types of abuse cases, it was almost the uncertainty of when it would come that makes it even worse. The fact that you had nobody to then step in and stop that from happening, because my father was away for work most times. My mother often was just powerless in front of him. So as a result, I needed something. And from a very young age, from the time I can remember, in fact, cricket was that savior. Because when the cricket was on, I was the cricket guy from the time I can remember. Like I said, but from the time I was 6 or 7, I just knew stats. I knew backstories. I listened to the commentary. So when the cricket was on, I felt safe. But then if India lost, that's when I would be most worried, because it meant the world to my brother and to an extent my father as well. As a result, from a very young age, I could never support India. I still can't, just because, you know, it meant so much to him. It was almost like my sort of quiet rebellion, I suppose, to my reality. And you know, I chose the West Indies. And not to forget, this wasn't the West Indies of old where they were beating all comers and they were the best team in the world. This was the West Indies that had started losing. And maybe it was their underdog reputation that was building around them that drew me to them, which meant that often when the India West Indies game was on, and my mother at one point insisted that we get a second TV and put it in the tiny bedroom. So it was a two-room kitchen flat, as they say in Bombay. So she insisted that my father buy a small television set for the other room, just so that I could be locked in there whenever India West Indies played and not get into trouble. But I just couldn't help it. Every time Sachin Tendulkar got out, I would run out and jump and dance in front of my brother and try to escape back into that room. Most times I didn't make it scot-free. So cricket was everything. And it felt like till the time either the cricket was on or I had cricket going in my life, it would keep me safe. And well, it did keep me safe and kept me alive in different ways later on in life. But even growing up, it was my only friend.
We're speaking with Bharat Sundarasan on The Year That Made Me. And Bharat, obviously you were passionate about cricket, but you also got into music and heavy metal music in particular. What was the heavy metal music scene like for you in Mumbai, and how was it received by others?
It was almost like an underground movement. So wherever you, whichever metal concert you went to, heavy metal concert, you'd meet the same people. A lot of men with long hair, a lot of black t-shirts. And I mean, few people believe me when I say this. I used to be one of them as well. I mean, there was a period in my life only wore black t-shirts, because that's what you do when metal is in your life, as they say. Or as my former guitarist used to say, metal's not music, it's a way of life. And I really believed in that way of life to an extent. With it came the excesses. And so what happened was, when my brother left for the US on July 29, 2002, and I remember that date vividly, because that's the day I finally felt liberated. And that's the day I started growing my hair. So my hair is very personal to me. It's not fashion. It's not religion. It looks bloody good. But, you know, the reason for me being so precious about it is because it is a reminder of what I was like before I started growing my hair, that very uncertain, insecure kid, and what became of me after that. But with music or metal music at that point, there was also a lot of indulgences, whether it was excessive alcohol or basically just recreational drugs to start with. But looking back at it, because I was in a place in my life where I just wanted to take everything to the extreme, you know, it went from getting together to jam and create some music and having some, you know, drug usage on the side to, oh, let's meet and drink and get high. And then let's see if we can make music. So I started drifting further away from music. And I also started drifting further away from my reality and, you know, just, you know, being present in this world.
And I think that brings us, Bharat, to the year you've chosen as the year that made you. What year have you chosen and why?
It's 2007. So I would have turned 22 in May that year. The reason I've chosen 2007 is because that was the year where everything changed, everything turned around for me. And it was also the year where my chapter should, in all likelihood, have been closed, because that's when I suffered my second overdose. And that's the closest I came to losing my life. And looking back at it, I still am not sure why I was given this third chance to live, because in 2005, I'd had my first overdose and I'd survived it. And because I was young and foolish, it also made me a bit of a cult hero. It gave me an invincibility complex and also made me the cool guy who could just go around telling people about, hey, you know what? I actually survived an overdose. And you know, I mean, we've all been young and stupid, some longer than others. So, and then when it happened again in 2007, around the middle part of the year, to just sum it up in a couple of lines, it basically starts in your head, where you completely lose control of your brain. But then what happens is all your other faculties start shutting down. And I remember very vividly, and my overdose was one where I remember exactly what happened to me. I had to will myself to stay alive. And there was a part of me who said, what am I going to lose if I just don't stop breathing now? Like, what do I have in life? But then the other part of me kept reminding me that, no, I still have cricket in my life. Brian Lara flashed before my eyes and what he had meant to me, you know, when I was growing up. And the most important thing that I remember thinking is, I'm going to die a loser. I'm going to be this 21, 22-year-old kid who, you know, I mean, his parents were good people. I was given opportunities in life and I've just thrown it away for no reason, really. And I'll be remembered as that good-for-nothing young kid who just threw it all away and died a loser. It was that thought more than anything else that really willed me into continuing to breathe, because it took a lot of effort, I remember physically, to keep breathing, but I did. And then I came out the other side, and that's when I took a vow to never, you know, indulge in any sort of drug use. I mean, I overcame or kind of dealt with it by drinking a lot for a while there, smoking a lot of like cigarettes back in the day, but that kind of, you know, took its own course. And then now I'm in a great place with both those things. I haven't smoked a cigarette in more than 7 years, and I don't think I'll ever do that again. I still enjoy a drink, but it's never excess. But it was a significant moment which just changed. I mean, significant would be underplaying it. It was the biggest turning point in my life, where I went from nearly dead to almost feeling like a different person. You know, people speak about being born again. I was literally born again, because that chapter ended that late evening and a new chapter began. And, you know, even though I'm 41 years old now, I still feel like somewhere I've just turned 20 just now.
And so this new born again Bharat had a few other big things happen in the year of 2007 on the professional front and on the personal front. Tell us about the rest of your year.
Well, all I'll say is when I mentioned this to Isha, my wife, that I'm going to be doing this interview, she said, you obviously are going to pick the year you met me, right? I said, hey, of course I'm going to. So, and that is not the only reason I picked 2007, because you're right. 2 months after my overdose, when I survived, I ended up going to a journalism school in Chennai, which was where my ancestry is from, but also a city in the southern part of India. And the only reason I chose to do it, and I wasn't someone who grew up wanting to be a journalist. Like, I went from being someone, like so many kids in India, wanting to play cricket at the highest level, to then wanting to be a drummer in a heavy metal band and do that for the rest of my life, to becoming a wastrel. So journalism was just something that came along purely because it was in another city. And I told myself, if I can take myself out of this situation, even if it's for 10 months, I'm giving myself a chance to stay true to my vow, because I wasn't 100% confident that I might not slip back into doing what I was doing. And I don't think I would have got a fourth chance or a third chance. So that's when I went to Chennai, and on day one of journalism school, well, I saw, as I described to her the first time I met her, the most beautiful girl I'd seen in my life, Isha Chatterjee. And the first words I ever uttered to her were exactly those words on day two of the journalism course, which she obviously remembers it differently, because she says, oh, I thought you were a creep. Definitely not. she was taken aback. And that is also a significant moment, because I realized why I never fit into Indian society. Not having a filter and being someone who spoke his mind in a good way without any vested interests, I felt like the fact that the entire computer lab, yes, boys and girls, there used to be an era where we used to go to university and work out of computer labs, as you would remember. The fact that there was a pin drop silence in the room when I said what I did to Isha kind of told me, firstly, I thought, oh, I've just outed myself out and there's 9 months and 28 days to go to finish this course. But the other thought was, I think I might have to change the way I live my life if I have to survive in this country. But hey, a month or so later, Isha and I, she came to me. I avoided her the plague for a couple of months so that she doesn't think ill of me. And then she came one day and we started chatting, and we became best friends, and we remain best friends what nearly 20 years later, and we've been married for nearly 14 of those years. And yeah, I mean, part, I guess she's part of the biggest turning point in my life. And the fact that it all happened in the space of a couple of months, and also, you know, going to journalism school meant I got into the habit of writing, and then I started enjoying the process of storytelling and became a journalist at the end of the course. And here I am. So none of this happens if I hadn't gone to Chennai, if I hadn't met Isha, and if I hadn't trusted myself to become a different person or a new person and stick to my vow.
It is really a beautiful thing, the way that you and Isha clicked somehow. Obviously, you had trouble fitting in the life that you'd been living so far. What do you think it was about the two of you that really clicked?
I think at some deep level, we still talk about it. We were both outsiders. And she was this gorgeous Bengali woman growing up in a very conservative family where she was expected to be a certain way, dress a certain way, speak a certain way. That was her reality. And she was always, from a young age, she wanted to break free from it. She wanted to be who she was. But it's not easy when you're a woman in India, especially it wasn't back then. So she had to kind of live within that template. But she wanted to break free. And I guess then she found the wildest man she'd ever met in her life. And it rubbed on her. And for the longest time, she lived vicariously through me, I must admit. Just the fact that I lived with such freedom, and the fact that, you know, I was in that kind of space in my life as well, where because of the second overdose, and I always talk about it, where from that day onwards, I think of every single day of my life as a bonus. Even now, when I wake up, the first thing I do is, even before brushing my teeth, I look into the mirror, I find a mirror firstly, and I remind myself of how lucky I am. And I say, another day has ticked past, which means that's another day that I need to now make the most of it. And doing what? By spreading love and just hugging people and kissing people and just basically making sure that I put smiles on people's faces. So that has been my purpose in life. And so in the early years of us being together, she lived vicariously through it. And over time, I think I'm so proud of the ways that she's been able to find her own self, but also find her freedom. I'm so grateful that I had an opportunity to be a vehicle for her to do that. And where she is now, and the amazing success that she's got in her professional career, but also the love that she's able to spread in such real fashion wherever she goes, almost puts a tear in my eye when I look back at her journey, which has gone alongside mine.
On the Year That Made Me, we're speaking with Bharat Sundarasan, cricket commentator extraordinaire, and also a poet and an ambassador for Red Room's Poetry Month in 2026. And Bharat, the second innings is a literal event in cricketing circles, but it does seem a very apt metaphor for the second phase of your life as you've described it. And indeed, it is the title of one of your poems. I wonder if you would read for us Second Innings.
I must admit, this is my first ever attempt at poetry. I've always backed myself to be a storyteller, and throughout my life, whether it's through the way I've written on cricket and sport for the last 20 years, or my commentary, or even not so great attempts at writing music back in the day. But so when Red Room Poetry approached me to be a poetry ambassador, I was just a bit intimidated by the prospect of writing my first ever poem. But I thought I should keep it real, and they wanted me to add a bit of cricket to it. So it's about three very significant moments in my life, a couple that I mentioned earlier, but it's I've tried to keep it as close to sounding like a game of cricket as possible. So here we go. So it's Second Innings by me, Bharat Sundarasan. They huddled around me like close-in fielders on a Mumbai dust bowl. A couple stood a few feet away, hands clasping their knees. The other two much closer, crouched low right under my nose, to catch anything that came their way, to catch every last breath of mine, from silly mid-on to silly mid-off, from silly point to short leg. They seemed familiar, friends and acquaintances, teammates even, but in that moment, They seemed distant, there with me, but not there for me. All waiting to see if I could survive. Survive till stumps, survive to fight another day. Through a final over being played out to an audience of one. At the crease, taking strike inside my head. This was my second overdose. Cricket, a metaphor for life. Cricket, a metaphor in death. A second overdose. Second innings is what I'd wished for. I'd somehow walked away unscathed with a red inker. Remained not out, making me a cult hero by circumstance. The one who faced death and kept his wicket intact. A batter who'd been gifted a life. I began playing my shots with gay abandon. It became a kamikaze mission. That's what had brought me back here, on the precipice, batting for survival again. Somehow it felt bleaker this time, the surface trickier to overcome. As I slipped in and out of consciousness, it came to me. I no longer control the outcome. This was a battle beyond my faculties, a tug of war between the subjective and objective, reality slipping as rapidly as the fielders closing in. While 21 years of life flashed past my eyes, the few triumphs, the many setbacks, the mistakes, and lessons from the only guardian I'd ever had, my cricket. I knew the only way out was playing one ball at a time, on taking one breath at a time. Nothing extravagant, nothing audacious. Defend. Breathe. Everyone has different experiences of overdoses. Some remember bits and pieces, others remember nothing. Mine are etched, a TV show binged watched on repeat. I can't tell you how long I fought to hang in there. I was still there in the end, unbeaten but not unscathed. This felt different, like I was given a chance to pad up again. Cricket, a metaphor in death. Cricket, a metaphor for life. Second innings. That's what I have been on ever since. Cricket saved my life. Now I'm paying back in style. Putting a price on your wicket. Building from scratch. Backs to the wall. Following on. Earning the right to express yourself. Treating every run as a bonus. Gratitude when they huddle around me. Arms wide open. Launching or accepting bear hugs. To catch every ball of positivity, warmth, and love. Embracing myself, figuring out what lay within. The field of color and the madness. To share the kindness with every breath I take. Everyone who comes my way seems familiar. Old teammates I've known all along. They are here with me. They are here for me. Every day, a fresh over. Mark your guard and away you go again. Smile, laugh. Pass it on. Maybe I was always made for Australian pitches. Here's where I've truly found myself. Here's where I truly feel in control at the crease. Cricket, a metaphor for life. We don't talk death anymore.
That was Second Innings by Bharat Sundarrajan. Thank you so much for reading that, Bharat. And well, you know, if cricket doesn't work out for you, I think you might have a future as a poet.
Oh, thank you so much. I've never backed myself to be someone who can do rhymes. I know poetry is not always about rhyming, but I just wrote with my heart and I ended up writing it in, I think, within 90 minutes. It all just came out. I mentioned the fact that I'd survived a couple of overdoses in the past, but I'd never really broken down what really happened while I was going through it. So I thought this was a great opportunity to do that. And I had enough cricket analogies to play with.
Well, one of them is about feeling comfortable on Australian wickets. Could you tell us a little bit more about the decision you and Isha made to move to this country?
Oh, very much so. I mean, you speak of turning points. I guess that when you look back at the last 8 years I've had in this beautiful country, proudly calling myself an Australian and a mighty South Aussie at that. It's just, I wouldn't even say it's a dream come true because I don't think you can dream of such fairy tales. This is not a life that can be scripted. So I just go with the flow and enjoy every day. And it all started with my first trip to Australia as an Indian cricket journalist. The first city I spent a lot of time in was Adelaide. And I warmed to Adelaide because it just felt so different to where I come from. And I remember just, you know, thinking about it or fantasizing about it, or how cool it would be to live in a city so diametrically opposite to A city with 27 million people like Bombay or Mumbai. But unfortunately for us, we couldn't do the conventional thing of applying for permanent residency and moving here as a couple. We don't come from money. Journalists and teachers, it's a great combination if it works out, but you're also talking about two professions that are highly underpaid, as you well know. So we were in a position where we had to take a risk, and which meant I sat Isha down and I said, the only way this is going to happen if we had to move to Australia is you'll have to go first and do your master's, because she was very keen on doing a master's in special education, which is, she's been a special needs teacher for a long time now, but she didn't have an actual academic degree. So we decided that she'll have to come here first, where I managed to somehow get a student loan and I paid off from there, and all I could do was send her tuition fees. So she had to come here by herself, live here for 2 years and sort everything else for herself, whereas I lived there, I had to move back into my mother's house, which is rather uncomfortable, but it was a sacrifice we made. And we basically gambled on everything. We gambled on our livelihood. We gambled on the rest of our lives, considering if this didn't work out, we had nothing to fall back on and it would have been all a big disaster. And most importantly, I think we gambled on our marriage. We'd been together a long time and we trusted our relationship, but to know that we'll be away from each other for 2 years, not knowing whether we'll even be able to see each other in that period, was a huge risk to take. But it just felt like something had to give. It felt like we were going nowhere in India in our personal and professional lives, even though we were enjoying doing what we were doing for a living. And a risk is what we took. And I mean, 100% credit to her for making all of this come true. It's one thing when you move to another country, when you're in your early 20s, then, you're full of dreams and ambitions. But she came here when she was 30, having left a largely settled life. It wasn't easy. She worked 3 jobs. I found out later she went hungry many nights to make sure that she had enough to just survive on. And 20 months later, she finished her master's, got a job. And that's when we finally decided. I mean, firstly, she said, oh, you know what? I don't mind having you back in my life. So I said, yay. and that's when I decided to move here. And by this time, I'd been a cricket journalist for 10 and a half years. And Crick Buzz, who I still write for, they were keen to make me their Australian correspondent. And it all just worked out seamlessly. It was the easiest move for me. I remember literally leaving India with a backpack and nothing else. So, December 2018, I landed in Adelaide. Within a couple of days, I was covering a test match. That's a different story. That didn't go down well with Isha, but and we haven't looked back since. We haven't had time to look back since, because it's been such a crazy, incredible ride ever since. But none of this happens if Isha hadn't, really led the way and struggled through those 20 months to make sure that we have the life we do now.
And you've really been embraced by the Australian cricketing community, and in no small part because you're such a vibrant burst of positivity and spirit, Bharat. But it's also been interesting that you decided to speak honestly about some of the experiences of racism that you've experienced. I wonder if you could speak to us about your decision to do that and how it was received.
It wasn't a natural choice, or I never really thought I would be someone who would talk about things that for a while didn't affect me. And what I mean by that is just a bit of a history lesson. So when I came here to Australia for the first time, it was 2014, I remember going to a town called Maxwell. And this is when Philip Hughes, unfortunately, had passed away. And that's the little town he belonged to. So I'd gone there two days before his state funeral to kind of just do a story on where he came from and speak to a few people who would have known him when he was growing up. And once I was done with my interviews, I remember sitting in the one pub in Maxwell, just by the water there. I remember there was a big guy, a big bald hunk of a man, and a white man was sitting across the table from me. And he just looked at me and he asked me, "Oh, mate, are you a terrorist, mate? Are you a terrorist? Do you have a bomb in your bag, mate?" And I do a very good Northern Australian accent, as you just picked up there. And because I was someone who was born with, or I have very thick skin, and I never got intimidated by any kind of, you know, discrimination of that nature. I just turned around and said, mate, if anything, you look like a bomber. And what I meant by that was just his size. And his mates thought that was the funniest thing that they'd heard. And within an hour or so, he was buying me beers and at one point even asking me to stay back the night with him. So, which did not happen, but it was an interesting turn of events. And the reason I bring that up is that's who I was. I never really took too much notice of what people were saying about me because I knew I could handle myself and give it back in jest, like, you know, not in a not in a way where I was going to get angry with them. So that went on for a while, but then I started witnessing acts of racism, not just against me, but other people that I know and I don't know, people of from different races and ethnicities. And the first time I ever said anything about it was when an Indian fast bowler was alleged to have been racially abused by a section of the crowd in Sydney. And he even stopped play, if you remember. And, play had to resume after he made an official complaint about a bunch of, white Australian fans there. And that was the first time I almost felt ashamed that I had been the guy who would just, because I could handle it and not be affected by it, I just, turned it into my superpower, almost like, use my sense of humor to just underplay it. And I thought I'm not being fair to the rest of people who come from different parts of the world and who are colored and who face it on a daily basis wherever they go. So that's the first time I decided to talk about it. But then a few years after that, I remember there'd been a few incidences where I had been very obviously racially profiled by some security guards at some cricket stadiums. And then I felt like this is my safe space. And if I'm getting questioned and if I'm getting abused here, then I almost feel like I need to do something. And full credit to, the Australian cricket media and the team and the former players, because the one thing they've always done is they've always kind of tried to protect me from all of that as much as possible. But when I felt like it was going out of control, I remember just putting a social media post out, which I regretted immediately because I don't like to make it about myself. But then that went viral and I was asked by the Sydney Morning Herald to write a piece about just what it feels like to experience it. And I'm not kidding, when I sat down to write it, I didn't know what I was going to say, but it all just came pouring out about the various experiences, some pretty grave, some just annoying, that you experience on a day-to-day basis at airports, at hotels, at restaurants, at traffic lights and everywhere else. And it all just came out. And I remember reading the piece after I'd written it and going, wow, I didn't realize that I was actually being affected so much by this. And then, that feeling that you get of when there's any kind of discrimination, it's like these little punches to your face that kind of add up. And then finally they grow into something. And I just realized if I do have, and by this time, people around Australia knew who I was. I had a platform, I had a voice. And I felt that if I wasn't using that voice to talk about this or to just talk about what it feels like and to call people out, then I'm just being dishonest and I'm just wasting my voice. And that was a big kind of eye-opener for me. And from that point on, I've just realized, I just have to do it whenever I feel like there is some sort of discrimination, whether it involves me or anyone else. It is my duty, not just my responsibility, to stand up and speak up for them. Because, and even if it means I get, whether it's death threats or whether it's hate towards my family, I'm ready to cop that if even one person benefits from me sticking my neck out.
Well, Bharat, it's been fantastic speaking with you on The Year That Made Me. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And we always finish with a piece of music. Your choice. What have you chosen for us and why?
So it's The End by The Doors. And there's a very specific reason for me choosing that song, because I said 2007 was my year, the most important year of my life. And while I was going through my overdose, I had a few of my friends with me who witnessed it happening. For some reason, in a show of solidarity, they all got together and started singing, "This is the end, my beautiful friend," and which I still remember thinking at that point as I went in and out of consciousness going, oh, so they've decided this is my end as well. So there's a massive tinge of irony to the fact that that is the song I choose.
Well, we're very glad it wasn't, but it is now the end. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.